Fuck the team name. You don't have to go to Steve Bothell. But it be Steve Bothell Incorporated, a systems analysis operation that does work for the federal government. Dr. Bothell will be speaking to us on Beyond the Shadow of a Doubt, Logical Deduction in the Reasoning Process. Bothell is a graduate of Dartmouth, PhD in math, and since then has done his Master's of Divinity here at Biblical Seminary. He is living over in the main line, where he has a Bible study for a number of students at Renoir and various other prestigious colleges over there. So we welcome Dr. Bothell tonight to speak to us on Beyond the Shadow of a Doubt, Logical Deduction in the Reasoning Process.
Thank you, Dr. Newman. I am awed by the credentials, but maybe I'll be able to manage anyway. I have written out most of what I'm going to say, and if you, with your permission, I'd like to read a good bit of it because it's very, very dense. I mean, heavily compacted, let's put it that way, and I hope more or less understandable. But that's where we'll go. I start my talk with a quotation from Anatole France, The Garden of Epicurus. The man will always have the crowd with him who is as sure of himself as he is of the world at large. That is what the crowd likes. It demands categorical statements and not proofs. Proofs disturb and puzzle it. It is simple-minded and only understands simplicity. You must not tell it how or in what way, but simply say yes or no. Modern society harbors two fundamental delusions. The first delusion is that religion is at root an irrational psychological response to the unknown. Don't misunderstand the tolerance of religion that is generally advocated in Western societies. It's not quite as high-minded as it may seem. For the majority of people, it is just a benign way to accommodate an irrational factor of life. While Christians should welcome the tolerance, they should at the same time understand its principal basis. Unfortunately, we will not talk about this particular delusion, but the second delusion is the one we will discuss tonight, that there is an unbreachable barrier placed between truth and the real world. Pilate's retort to Jesus, "What is truth?" is, I believe, a cynical commentary on the vanity of the search for truth, as seen by educated people of his time. But the message of the Bible is that the quest for truth is a matter of eternal consequence, and that every man's most important task in life is to know and serve the true God. With this kind of message, how can a Christian then go on to affirm that there is no way for a human to come to a knowledge of truth, particularly if Christianity is held up to be a reasonable faith? Even arguing for the work of the Holy Spirit in Revelation and in drawing men to salvation does not remove the need to affirm that truth is accessible through reason. And in fact, the scripture constantly appeals to reason to demonstrate the truth of what it claims and argues for the importance of study by each believer. It is this search for truth that concerns us tonight. How do we come to know something in our daily lives? What is the activity of the mind that is called the reasoning process? What about that barrier between truth and the real world? Why is it thought to exist, and how can we as Christians answer the accusation of being ignorant if we believe, as we do, that truth is attainable? The facts are these. The matter of the mind and the stuff the mind works with and the way the mind does its tasks are quite different from the matter and stuff of wisdom as it is viewed by modern intellectuals. Why does this difference exist? Is it a virtue or is it a fault? These are the questions we will address. We will begin with the mind side of the issues. Above all, the mind works. It manages quite nicely to handle the reasoning tasks it faces in daily life. This is a virtue that should not be ignored. How does the mind work? How does it come to know facts beyond the shadow of a doubt? Perhaps if we can find some answers about this, then they may provide some insight into the more general question of truth. My particular interest is to approach these questions from the viewpoint of recent research in artificial intelligence, what we call AI. With your permission, I'll use that acronym, although I suppose in polite society you shouldn't use abbreviations like that. What I hope to do tonight is help you to understand some implications of AI research and how we as Christians should relate to it. Since AI is by its very name associated with intelligence, that is, with the way the human mind works, it seems useful to start with some remarks about the reasoning process. Since the whole range of academic pursuit has to do with the reasoning process, we will then go on to some remarks about the current state of scholarly research in its treatment of the reasoning process and where I believe things are headed. I intend to argue that the current research in AI, and in particular, the developments in computer technology that support artificial intelligence, come at a critical time in history, and that Christians should welcome this research with an intelligent understanding of why it is needed and how it relates to their understanding of the Christian faith. Let's begin with some examples, some thought experiments that will help to focus on how the mind works. These experiments have to do with three common activities that the mind engages in every day. First, visual recall. Second, visual recognition. And third, speech. Each experiment illustrates some aspect of how the mind works. First experiment, visual recall. You engage in visual recall every time you try to remember where you put something. The intriguing question is, how does the mind do it? Actually, there are two types of visual recall. One type, which we may call expected recall, occurs when you anticipated the need. For example, locating your car in the parking lot of a shopping mall. The other type, unexpected recall, occurs when there was no advance notice given. Let's focus on unexpected recall. Suppose I ask some questions about a recent event. For example, consider where you parked your car on the way to this talk. You may prepare your mind for the inquiry by conjuring up some kind of mental image of the parking area, but yet you have no idea of what I am going to ask. In fact, I could ask you a wide range of questions ranging from general to specific, and if you are a typical person, you will be able to answer the questions adequately without too much difficulty. How dark was it into the lot? How far could you see? Where did you park? Did you park next to another car? How many other cars were there? What kind of car was it? Who was the first person you met? How does your mind perform this recall? The computer novice would probably assume that somewhere in your brain is a detailed bitmap of every visual image you picked up on the way to this meeting, and that you consult this picture to perform the recall. This is nonsense. It cannot be true, because the required communications load on the neural network, the physical amount of storage required, and the time to perform the memory recall would all be too great. You may be impressed by the number of cells that make up the brain, it's on the order of a trillion, but no amount would be enough for indiscriminate, literal storage of visual images. Let's pause for a moment to think about the communication problem. Transferring information from the eye to the brain or wherever the data is stored for future recall. How does the mind communicate visual information over the neural network? In particular, how much information, in terms of individual bits or pieces of data, is actually communicated? Recently, I did some work for Johns Hopkins University in which the issue was to estimate the communications capacity needed to do large area surveillance from a satellite or by some other means. The answer for your information is in the order of millions of bits per second. Communication of a single black and white image to a reasonable level of detail requires something on the order of 10,000 individual pieces of information. And this assumes some kind of pre-processing to remove uninteresting data. With this kind of background information, I was very interested to see what the corresponding communication rates are for human visual perception. Now, I had an awful hard time getting the information. I may be totally wrong, but I think I'm in the general range of right. I believe, from what I understand, the maximum data rate over the neural system appears to be something in the order of 1,000 bits per second. From what I can gather, think of this as 1,000 pieces of information. From what I can gather, this is an aggregate figure. The optic nerve has on the order of 1 million individual fibers, but a fiber has a maximum data rate on the order of 25 bits per second, which is a number based on physical and chemical limitations of the cells. Brain waves, which I assume relate somehow to individual cell reactions, although that is a big open question as far as I know, are measured to frequencies up to 50 hertz, which would relate from communications theory to a data rate a reliable data rate on the order of 25 bits per second. Well, even if I'm off by a factor of 10 or 100, these data rates would not support very much literal processing of images. Evidently, the mind engages in a lot of economizing to reduce the data load by intelligent processing of the data. Let me tell you what your mind did when you parked your car tonight. Be assured you did not record a mental snapshot of the parking lot. What you did when you parked your car was mentally note a few general facts, particularly differences between your immediate impressions and past experience under similar circumstances. Depending on your particular interests, each of you may have recorded some different data. Perhaps one of you is a car buff. You may have noted some details about the other cars in the area. Or if you are so inclined, you may have noted the clothes worn by the person you met on the way in. When you ask questions in unexpected recall, you build up images from this limited amount of factual data, filling in the blank areas based on a general familiarity with the scene. Some workers in artificial intelligence refer to these familiar situations as frames. The difference between expected and unexpected recall is in the amount and types of actual data that you've stored away. The method of handling visual recall is remarkably efficient in that it avoids what would otherwise be a prohibited amount of unneeded data storage of visual impressions. If you agree that this is roughly how you perform unexpected visual recall, then you can see a number of things come together. For one thing, a whole area of interesting research is opened up. What are the familiar scenes that the mind uses to reconstruct images, and how are they stored? Hint, nowhere in your head do you have a bitmap of a Volkswagen Beetle. Those of you who know what a bitmap is, that means something too. If you don't know what a bitmap is, it doesn't mean anything anyway. My guess, which I believe is consistent with some views of cognitive psychology, is that a familiar image is built up of layer upon layer of other familiar images. For another thing, you can see that how it is possible to have faulty recall without realizing it. If you are unobservant, then in your reconstruction, you may see things in the scene that aren't in fact there. A camera that just records a picture is just a camera. A camera that records a summary of the picture is a smart camera. The science of artificial intelligence as applied to image processing has to do with building smart cameras. The prototype for this is the way the mind does it. A naive person may be fooled into thinking that a very dumb camera is in fact smart. The easiest thing to do is record all the data, and if that is done, then amazing detail in recall is possible, perhaps far exceeding what the mind can do. After all, if the entire picture is recorded, then you can not only count the cars, but count the bricks in the wall as you pass, that you pass on the way in. A person would be dazzled by the detail. But that is not the essence of intelligence. To appreciate true intelligence, recall that the mind is recording visual impressions with the view to economy of effort, and that is needed in order to avoid being overwhelmed by the sheer amount of irrelevant and redundant facts. The correct viewpoint is not recall of a single particular photograph, but from a lifetime's worth of images continuously received and recorded for rapid recall, frequently with no particular notion of how or whether the data will be used. The amazing stories of artificial intelligence almost always deal with very restricted particular tasks, not the general tasks that the mind does with unequaled ability. Now the second experiment, visual recognition. Vision is the process of seeing. It's not quite as simple as aiming a camera and snapping away. In fact, mere seeing is not much use unless it's able to interpret what it sees. Visual recognition is the aspect of vision in which you recognize something to be a familiar object. Visual recognition is such a commonplace activity of the mind that we hardly give it a thought. However, it has puzzled philosophers and scientists throughout the ages. Plato puzzled over how the mind recognizes that an object is a chair, when chairs come in so many different forms. You might think, however, in this day of high-powered computers, that kind of recognition task would be fairly easy. In fact, it's quite hard. In fact, no computer today can do so simple a thing as pick a cat out of a scene. A.K. Dewdney, a popular author who writes for Scientific American, described a fictitious device called a perceptron as follows. Imagine a black box, rather like a camera. At the front is a lens, and on one side is a dial with various settings, such as tree, house, cat, and so on. With the dial set to cat, we go for a walk, and presently we encounter a cat sitting on the neighbor's porch. When the box is aimed at the cat, a red light goes on. When the box is aimed at anything else, the light remains dark. Inside the box is a digital retina sending impulses to a two-layered logical network, an instance of the device called a perceptron. At one time, it was hoped that perceptrons would ultimately be capable of real-world recognition tasks like the one described in the fantasy above, but something went wrong. What went wrong is that human vision is a very complex operation. It is not merely a matter of receiving and processing light impulses as a camera would. An intricate and largely ununderstood kind of intelligent processing goes on simultaneously with the vision. The fictitious perceptron, mentioned by Dewdney, represents this unknown processing. To see how such a perceptron would work, pick some common visual object, such as the cat. Try to find out how your mind recognizes that object when you see it in your vision. Consider how that recognition works when various things intrude to obscure or confuse the image. It is partly hidden in grass or behind a tree. It's nightfall and the light is dim. Rain or fog obscures the view. How is two-dimensional recognition from a photograph or a motion picture different from three-dimensional recognition? Does the movement affect the identification? Also ask how your mind can sometimes be fooled by camouflage or other means. Sometimes it's the failures that give the best indications of how the mind works. Not only is current computer technology unable to make a perceptron, even tasks that seem much simpler are still beyond reach. For example, recognition of a printed letter, such as a capital A, and all the various forms it can take. Doug Hofstadter summarizes the problem of vision as follows in his book, Metamagic of Themes. Quote, each letter of the alphabet comes in literally thousands of different official versions, that is, typefaces, not to mention the millions, billions, and trillions of unofficial versions, those handwritten ones that you and I and everyone else produce. There thus arises an obvious question. How are all the A's like one another? The problem of intelligence, as I see it, is to understand the fluid nature of mental categories, to understand the invariant horrors of precepts such as your mother's face, to understand the strangely flexible yet strong boundaries of concepts such as chair or the letter A. The central problem of artificial intelligence is the question, what is the letter A and the letter I? By making these claims, I have been suggesting that for any program to handle letter forms with the flexibilities that human beings do, it would have to possess full-scale general intelligence. Clearly, although we do not know the details, the mind performs vision by combining a few pieces of visual data with a lot of processing. As the eye looks, the mind is active extracting, evaluating, and comparing the visual impressions with familiar objects that it has in its memory. This activity takes place almost instantaneously, so we know that it does not require a very large amount of recall or computation. Third experiment, speech and communications. Speech, which is the way humans convey information to one another, is perhaps the most profound activity of the human mind. The fact that we express ourselves in discrete words, which you can even point to and count if you like, has deluded many people into thinking that there is something essentially simple about speech and related activities. In fact, one of the earliest uses suggested for a computer was automatic translation from one language to another. A recent assessment of that effort states, quote, in 1947, some prominent scientists confidently expected that mechanical translation between natural languages would be among the early important accomplishments of non-numerical computation. The first approaches to mechanical translation were based on the assumption that word-for-word substitution from a computer-accessible dictionary would result in usable translations. It was soon apparent that words had so many different meanings dependent on their uses in various contexts that purely lexical translation could not provide a satisfactory result. So emphasis shifted to a study of syntactical structure. Some improvements of translation resulted, but the vast scope of the problem of understanding the content of natural language texts became increasingly apparent. By 1960, several of the early workers had become thoroughly disillusioned. By 1970, only a trickle of funds was devoted to mechanical translation. Seldom does the meaning of a sentence reside in the words or even the phrases and clauses. In fact, our speech abounds in technical inaccuracies, and yet we are able to communicate quite well. If you really want to annoy your friends or appear to be mentally deficient, then insist on literal accuracy in speech. Imagine building a machine that was only 60% accurate and claiming that as a virtue. Associated with the question of speech is the issue of how the mind communicates with itself. So as a hint at the complexity of the problem, you may want to conduct some experiments with your thought processes. Consider how you think through things. Do you do it with the medium of language or in some other nonverbal way? This specific question has been asked a number of times with prominent scientists coming down on both sides of the issue. One scientist states, "I insist that words are totally absent from my mind when I really think. After reading or hearing a question, every word disappears at the very moment I am beginning to think it over. Words do not reappear in my consciousness before I have accomplished or given up the research." My personal opinion, based on informal inquiries with friends, is that there apparently are differences among people, not necessarily correlated to intelligence, that some think primarily in nonverbal, others in verbal ways. For our present purposes, this observation tends to support the thought that the information conveyed between individuals by the medium of language may involve an exceedingly complex interplay between words and concepts. Words are simply not used by the mind as separate entities. Even phrases and clauses are not the basic building blocks. Certainly, syntax is not the final residence of meaning. Almost every sentence that you speak paints a picture, hints at a concept, recalls some similitude. These are the real information conveyors, and until the understanding of language is extended to this dimension, it will not be possible to provide any artificial object with effective communication skills. I'd like to summarize these thought experiments. You can see that the potential, perhaps even the expectation, is present for the mind to be overwhelmed by the data assimilation tasks it faces every day. Certainly without the working example of the mind to prove that it is possible, we would surely conclude that it is not. A cyborg from some alien planet, presented with the above data, would laugh at the fictitious yarn being told. The mind does not exist, because what it does is not possible to do. However, since the mind does exist, and does in fact cope very well with its environment, it should be possible to find some rational explanation of how it works. The search into this explanation is the basis and motivation for research in AI. The trick apparently is in the data processing. The algorithms, that is, the logical steps and procedures that perform the processing, are the keys to the mind's ability to cope. For the most part, these algorithms are unknown to us today. It may be that the work needed to obtain a basic understanding will occupy men for centuries to come. For practical purposes, the state of progress to date in understanding how the mind works still has us stuck in the situation of being overwhelmed by the data, which, as viewed from the mind's perspective, is a very primitive state of progress. The curious thing is that the discussion we have had thus far is not significantly different from the type of discussion you would find in Plato or Aristotle, who lived 2,500 years ago. The main difference between those scholars and today's counterparts is that today we have learned to limit our discussion to things we know how to handle. Relative to a science textbook written today, Aristotle's physics would seem to range far off the subject and engage in all sorts of irrelevant speculation. This is simply because Aristotle had not limited his view to the narrow range of inquiry characteristic of modern science. In the process of this constriction, scientists have sometimes come by the gratuitous opinion that they understand how the world works. When we look at early efforts at research in AI, as we will shortly, as well as in other areas of science, we see this self-confident assertion at play. However, the facts indicate otherwise, and as you really consider the experiments mentioned here, you come to realize that we aren't as far progressed beyond Aristotle as we may have thought. Modern scholars have made marvelous strides in the handling of objective data, but that's like saying God did a marvelous job in building the eye. An eye is nothing without sight, and sight is useless without perception. The modern world has done almost nothing since the time of Aristotle in learning how to assimilate and process that data which it has so finely gathered. It is for this reason that I will assert below we are about to enter a new scientific renaissance, but this time one that places its main emphasis on processing data rather than just gathering it. At the start of this talk is a quote from Anatole France. The quotation refers to people who basically do not want to think. I would like, however, to consider a new twist. When faced with a situation that overwhelms your senses and your ability to think straight, the only apparent way to survive may be to hold the categorical statements rather than seek the truth. I think in a number of ways this modern age is in that situation. The explosion of information and the proliferation of facts and experts has made sensible management of the facts nearly impossible to do. There is a kind of saturation threshold in the assimilation of science. Free societies exist because of the free exchange of ideas, but a problem arises in distinguishing good from bad, particularly in the world of narrow expertise. Anatole France's observation may be true of us, even if we don't wish it to be. I recall back in the 1960s, men such as John Kemeny of Dartmouth talking about the coming information explosion. He had noted the explosive growth of literature, professional journals, and the like, and the predictable inability of libraries to cope with the massive flow. No longer could any person be an educated generalist. Only increasingly narrow specialists survive. The danger in this trend is the cacophony of conflicting information and the inability to evaluate it properly, which leads to misapplication and the use of irrational jumps of logic. You can see examples in this almost daily in the periodicals and literature. Nuclear winter, the space defense initiative, ecology, preserving the snail darter, problems of alleged global proportions, but increasingly specialized and narrow focus, beyond the ability of the average man to penetrate. This situation can lead to demagoguery, latching onto a person or idea or ideology for basically irrational reasons as a substitute for rational thought. I believe that we see evidence of this all around us today. The resolution to this information glut, if there is one, is the development of means for the educated person to evaluate and process the data. Specifically, highly advanced tools of artificial intelligence that can do for the educated person what the mind does with its own sense of data, process it to reduce the overwhelming load. This is the main need for the future. This is the main need of the future for progress in AI. Why it must succeed and why the Christians should welcome its coming. Our purpose in giving you these thought experiments about the mind's reasoning processes is not to conclude with the assertion that scientists working on artificial intelligence are working way over their heads, or even that no one will ever duplicate intelligence in a man-made device, although that may well be true. Actually, I have a much more important agenda, namely to note the relative infancy of current scientific research as compared with the most commonplace activity of the mind, and to show you something of the directions that science must go, what kind of problems it must handle if it is to mature in these areas. The root reason for our interest in the human mind is that the way the human mind goes about its business forms a prototype, a working model of the reasoning process, and therefore is a good thing to study in setting down the standards and methods of formal learning. This is not to say that the mind is an infallible guide, because we know all too well that the mind can be very fickle at times. The scholar must be careful in his use of a prototype. On the other hand, the mind has one strong point to commend its ways. It works, and for the most part, works very well. And it works well in the face of apparently overwhelming, discouraging obstacles. We will now turn to the question of how scholars have viewed this prototype, and this will help us to understand why the barrier to truth exists in the minds of many scientists and scholars. As scholars develop their methodology, their methods of argument, they start with a notion of how the mind works and then refine it to get at the essential features of proper thinking, removing the imperfections that they find in the process. What they view as proper methodology after this refining process, the correct way to think, determines how far they can go in the pursuit of wisdom and how relevant their findings will be to humanity. Let's start at the top. What is wisdom? And what is worthy of scholarly investigation? Here is an interesting point. The biblical view of wisdom is a fairly broad one, which includes all aspects of human activity. This view contrasts sharply with the usual view of modern Western society, which derives from a more restrictive classical Greek concept. In the article on the Hebrew word for wisdom, chokhmah, the theological word book of the Old Testament states, quote, the ethical dynamic of Greek philosophy lay in the intellect. The Hebrew wisdom covers the whole gamut of human experience. If you read the description of the craftsmen builders who constructed the wilderness tabernacle, you may be puzzled by the King James statement that they were, quote, filled with wisdom, unquote. Our contemporary notion of wisdom tends to exclude craftsmanship and technological skills. And this is reflected in the New International Version's rendering of the Hebrew as skill and ability. I suppose that this is the job of the NIV to change our culture's use of a word, but if you insist on using your more limited culturally induced definition of the word wisdom everywhere it appears in Scripture, you will miss much of the point of the biblical wisdom literature. In our modern intellectual world, some of the shibboleths and limitations of the Greek ancestry are still present. We sometimes poke fun at the ancient Greek's refusal to dirty his hands with practical investigations, but we still retain his concept of what real wisdom is as opposed to just skill and ability. Biblical authors would have thought it strange to talk of wisdom that is essentially amoral. But mathematical reasoning, which is the purest form of logical analysis in the Greek view, is just that. The most wicked person in the world could be a great mathematician. One of the embarrassments of the mathematical world is the fact that some prominent mathematicians, as well as other scientists, in the 1930s became ardent Nazis during World War II. Greek philosophers, on the other hand, would think it strange to put wisdom to the test of practicality. But the personified wisdom of Proverbs 8 is the craftsman at the side of God during the creation of the world. And the glory of the creation is that it is a supremely workable world, one in which all things fit together in a sustaining system. The clouds are set above, the sea has boundaries, the foundations of the earth are marked out. The same theme of harmony and workability is seen in the Lord's response to Job and his companions, beginning in Job chapter 38. All of God's creation fits together in a harmonious way. This concept of workability, that is utility, is not a strong motivation for Greek philosophy. Above all, the mind works. Scholarly methods do not in a fundamental way. As the earlier illustration of the camera demonstrates, the scholarly world has been deluded into thinking that excellence in a narrow task is equatable with all wisdom. In fact, its overall workability, the ability to sustain a workable, intelligent system in the face of all that is needed to sustain intelligent life, that is the true essence of wisdom. On the whole, I feel that scholars have not served mankind very well in adopting excessively restrictive notions in the matter of wisdom, particularly over the past few decades. The inadequacy of these notions has resulted in all kinds of strange warps and bends in academic circles, even leading to the introduction and tolerance of strange forms of mysticism and Oriental philosophy in the former hallowed halls of pure research. In fact, I strongly believe that one of the greatest dangers of the modern age is a general flight from rationality. This may sound incongruous in an age of science and technology, but it's striking to me to note how many highly educated scientists basically believe that the world they see is inherently self-contradictory. Consider the title of a recent book on modern physics, The Dancing Wu-Li Masters, and the theme of Doug Hofstadter's book, Gödel, Eckhart, Bach, which is that the absurd is normal, and inconsistency is a way of life. Woven through Hofstadter's book is a strong flavor of Eastern mysticism, especially Zen koans, the nonsense sayings. Some of this irrational bent is the result of having the orderly underpinnings of classical science knocked out from under the modern scientist. Ilya Prigogine, a prominent Belgian physicist, remarks, quote, the quest of classical science is in itself an illustration of the dichotomy that runs throughout the history of Western thought. Only the immutable world of ideas was traditionally recognized as illumined by the sun of the intelligible, to use Plato's expression. In the same sense, Only eternal laws were seen to express scientific rationality. Temporality was looked upon as an illusion. This is no longer true today. We find ourselves in a world in which reversibility and determinism apply only to limited, simple cases, while irreversibility and randomness are the rule. Unquote. This flight from rationality is an extremely important issue to face. It is a natural consequence of adopting a notion of demonstrable truth that is so narrow that it doesn't include the most essential activities of life, and therefore it is essentially unworkable. Many thinking people have the view that it is impossible to decide what is truth, which is a natural consequence of an overly restrictive rational methodology. This is the barrier mentioned at the start of the talk. Do we believe in the reasonableness of our faith? Then we must believe that there is a place for effective demonstration. What form must this take? What rules must it follow? Some people are content to set down rigid rules of how the world should be and leave it go at that, as if the compelling nature of their logic is the only thing that matters. Thus you have theologians such as Job's comforters who imagine how God must work based on some rigid concept of righteous behavior and the meaning of imperfection in the world, and you have scientists who laugh at the imperfections of the human eye and say, it must have been made by accident rather than by a designer. And you have logical purists who deny sensory experience as a valid avenue for learning truth. I believe such people miss an essential point, namely that if a thing is unworkable, it is not worth much. The marvelous thing about the mind's reasoning process is that it works. And science that doesn't work will not long continue to attract the mind's attention. It is for this reason that I believe that the world is situated today between two major eras of intellectual renaissance, and we are now in a period of intellectual turmoil that represents a transition between these two eras. This transition period may continue for many years. The resolution will be a broadening of the accepted definition of wisdom, and therefore of respectable academic pursuit, to coincide more closely to the prototype provided by the mind. The current spilling over into mysticism is an irrational overcompensation for the inadequacies of the current accepted academic ideas. To help understand the current state, we will now look more closely at the origins of modern academic methodology and how that methodology has fared over the past 30 years of work in artificial intelligence. Finally, we will conclude with an overall assessment and some suggestions of how the current turmoil will be resolved. I would like to discuss some of the origins of modern scholarly methodology. What scholars view as proper method determines how far they can go in the pursuit of wisdom. It is interesting to look at the history of philosophy from ancient times to the present in terms of this self-limitation. Our particular culture is part of the stream of philosophy that passed through ancient Greek and Egyptian cultures. We will now briefly pause to summarize this stream. As far as recorded history reveals, the early Egyptian and Greek philosophers were the first to develop a formal system of deductive logic, and then apply the concept of the development of knowledge as a process of logical deduction from first principles. Pythagoras and Euclid developed the procedures and applied them to mathematics and geometry. Socrates and Plato developed the techniques of dialogue. Sometime after Plato's time, Aristotle set down some principles of deductive logic which still are followed to this day. The concept that the logical deductive process was a reality in itself, so to speak, must have involved a tremendous struggle of conception and been a great breakthrough to the systematic development of knowledge when it was recognized. This concept is the essence of mathematics, which survives to this day as a major intellectual discipline, perhaps the purest form of objective science. In mathematics, if you state the prior assumptions, then any conclusion you claim must follow with no room for subjective opinion. The falsity of a mathematical claim can be proved by giving a single example where it fails to hold. This is such an ironclad fact that proof by contradiction is an accepted way of mathematical demonstration. The pivotal question from my modern point of view concerns the source of the first principles, and this proved to be the Achilles heel of ancient science. Aristotle stated the difficulty in his treatise, Posterior Analytics, quote, all instruction given or received by way of argument proceeds from pre-existent knowledge, unquote. Where did this pre-existent knowledge come from? distrust of the accuracy of the senses and of the reality of the outside world led to a view that the first principles should not come from empirical observation. Aristotle states, quote, "Our own doctrine is that not all knowledge is demonstrative. On the contrary, knowledge of the immediate premises, i.e. the first principles, is independent of demonstration," unquote. He views this as a necessary doctrine in order to avoid the problem of circular argument. Thus, Aristotle's Physics, which is a discourse on the nature of mass, motion, and similar subjects, contains very little reference to actual experimentation, and what is most frustrating to modern scientists, shows a preference to speculate about things rather than simply go and find out. For example, he argues that heavier things fall faster than lighter things. As an aside, Galileo, in his discourses in physics, also has a purely logical argument against this notion. And here's the argument. I just love this argument, so bear with me for a minute. If a heavier object falls faster than a lighter object, then bind the two together. The lighter object will retard the heavier, so the combination will fall slower than the heavier object alone. But the combination is even heavier. Contradiction. Therefore, objects fall at the same rate independent of weight. He didn't even need an experiment for that. I love that one. I gave that to when I was a college student, I gave that as a quiz to explain what was wrong with that argument. Needless to say, no one got it. You get a flavor of the profound distrust of empirical observations in the Platonic cave dialogues, in which it is observed that there is no fundamental way to be assured that your senses are conveying true information. Armed with the conviction that there is such a thing as true knowledge, Socrates developed the position that all knowledge is already inborn in the human, and the process of learning is a matter of drawing out this knowledge from the hidden resources of the mind, hence the Socratic dialogues. The methodology developed by Aristotle and his contemporaries held sway until the beginning of the modern era of science. With Galileo, Copernicus, Newton, and their contemporaries came the concept of empirical science. The concept evolved that the scientific method consists in logical deduction based on empirical observations. The problem of erroneous sensory perceptions, which stymied the ancient philosophers, was addressed by the notion of a reproducible experiment, and by refining the concept of measurement and the use of precisely crafted measuring devices. For the most part, this concept of knowledge has survived to the present. Science was released from the earlier necessity of divining the precise and logically necessary truth to that of developing models that are adequate to explain the results of reproducible experiments. The precision of logical deduction was carried over from an earlier era, but applied to this enriched base of first principles. The recent interest in artificial intelligence is a natural step in the search for an adequate grasp of the human reasoning process. Until the development of computers, the tools were simply not available to conduct the necessary investigations. These investigations were begun during a time when the scientific methodology derived from this stream of philosophy we have just discussed was accepted almost without question. Therefore, the work in AI provides an interesting textbook case of how that methodology has stood up. We are now some 30 years into the computer age, and one of the interesting facts of this period is the vigor with which inadequate views of the reasoning process have been smashed by the evidence that has evolved in the investigations. We will mention only a small amount of the work that's been done. Earlier in the talk, we made mention of the abortive efforts in speech synthesis and machine translation. First, Turing's experiment. One of the first people to explore the potential of computer programming was Alan M. Turing, who was a British scientist heavily involved in code breaking during World War II. In 1950, he wrote a paper entitled Computer Machinery and Intelligence, in which he predicted that computers were capable of imitating human intelligence perfectly, and indeed they would do so by the year 2000. He proposed an experiment in which a person could communicate over a teletype to another person or a computer, the object being for the first person to decide who he was talking to. Was he talking to another person or a computer? The human, on this side, would engage in a conversation designed to ask things that presumably only another computer, another human, would answer properly. The computer on the other end, if indeed it is a computer, has the job of responding in a way that is human-like, so as to fool the person. You understand the experiment? The irony of this experiment as it works out is that the computer has to be careful not to do things a human cannot do, such as do calculations too quickly, or answer complex logical questions without any errors. You may think it's a little strange that Turing suggested such an indirect definition of human intelligence. I believe that his definition is consistent with the general approach of the school of psychology, which holds that the only way to know about intelligence is to make objective observations of the effects or evidence of intelligence. By this view, if you have something that behaves like a human intelligence in all its measurable aspects, then for practical purposes, you have it. Turing, of course, left to the imagination what kinds of questions might be posed in his experiment, or how the human might infer the nature of his talkative companion. The implication that Turing drew from this thought experiment is that if it is not possible to tell the difference between a reasoning process of a computer and a human, then there is no essential difference. The Turing experiment has been tried many times, and in a sense has formed a focal point for a number of diverse investigations. The experiments have uniformly met with failure. In a sense, it's just too easy for a human to detect that his conversant is a computer. Most scientists are extremely doubtful that his experiment can be carried off successfully, and if so, whether such a success really says much meaningful about human intelligence. A hidden assumption in the Turing experiment is that it's possible to start with an ignorant computer and teach it all the tricks of the human intelligence so that it can ultimately pretend to be human. Is it possible to build up human intelligence from a blank slate, learning all that is needed by trial and error, building a base of knowledge by observing what works and what don't? A current textbook on artificial intelligence has this to say about that subject. Quote, "One idea that has fascinated Western minds is that there is a general purpose learning mechanism that accounts for almost all the states of an adult human being. According to this idea, people are born knowing very little and absorb almost everything by way of this general learner. This idea is still powerfully attractive. It underlies much of behavioristic psychology. AI students often rediscover it and propose to dispense with the study of reasoning and problem solving, instead just build a baby and let it learn these things. We believe this idea is dead, killed off by research in AI and linguistics and other branches of cognitive science. What this research has revealed is that for an organism to learn anything, it must already know a lot. Learning begins with organized knowledge, which grows and becomes better organized. Without strong clues as to what's to be learned, nothing will get learned." A second hidden assumption in the Turing test is that a computer can be taught to carry on a natural language dialogue. Earlier, we remarked on the failures of this area after substantial early interest in the 50s and 60s. One other survey summarized the current state of machine translation as follows, quote, "Perhaps the most influential critic of this work was a linguist, Bar Hillel, who in 1964 published a critique that pointed out there is no way to do word sense disambiguation without a deep understanding of what a sentence meant. In other words, you can't find out what it means until you know what it means. Some authors, noting the general failure of these experiments in artificial intelligence, have come to the conclusion that the missing ingredient is an adequate knowledge database. One author states, "For about 30 years, a small community of investigators has been trying with varying degrees of success to program computers to be intelligent problem solvers. By the mid-70s, after two decades of humblingly slow progress, workers in the new field of artificial intelligence had come to a fundamental conclusion about intelligent behavior in general. It requires a tremendous amount of knowledge, which people often take for granted, but which must be spoon-fed to a computer. This observation has led to some to advocate the development of huge knowledge-based systems. I have ambivalent feelings about this. Some people seem to have the opinion that all we need is computers with vast memory banks of stored knowledge. These people seem to me to fall into the trap of the behaviorists who thought you could just learn everything from a blank slate. Except I suppose they would have to agree with Socrates that much of the database of facts must reside in their minds at birth. While granting the need for a large database, my personal view is that a more important missing ingredient is an understanding of the mental processes that the mind uses to economize on the amount of factual data required. These areas of research are fairly representative of current work in artificial intelligence. What we see is strong evidence that there are fundamental missing components in the current scientific perception, because attempts to duplicate the mind's activity have not enjoyed much success. One author summarized the current situation as follows. Quote, "At present, artificial intelligence programs fall into these two groups. Those that perform one clearly defined task at human or near human standards, and those that perform more general tasks at drastically subhuman standards." Not even up to the idiot level. Assessment. Having discussed some of the experiments of how the mind works and how scholars view the pursuit of truth and the abortive efforts to explain the human reasoning process and perhaps also the press of modern information and the information glut, this brings us to the real purpose of this talk. Having reviewed where things are, let us ask, where are things going and why? And particularly, what should the Christian response be to events as they unfold? The importance of our finding a response is emphasized by the same author we just quoted, who stated this importance in the following way. Quote, "Many ages in the past have shown great promise while facing great difficulties. Yet our age is perhaps unique in that its problems and its promise come from the same source, from the extraordinary achievements of science and technology. Other factors have remained constant. Men and women are no more greedy, violent, compassionate, wise, or foolish than before, but they find themselves in command of a technology that greatly enhances their capacity to express these all-too-human qualities. Technology enables them to reshape nature to conform to their needs as far as possible to make nature over in their image. But it is a flawed image. Mankind is indeed both good and evil, and it is expected that human technology will sometimes harm nature rather than improve it. Until recently, however, our technical skills were so feeble in comparison with natural forces that we would not seriously affect our environment for good or ill, except over millennia. High technology promises to give us a new power over nature, both our own nature and that of our planet, so that the very future of civilization now depends on our intelligent use of high technology." The main thrust of what has been said thus far is this. If we use the mind's reasoning process as the prototype for academic methodology, then it must be concluded that the methodology at this time is not adequate to describe all the things that the mind does. It is not a full bag of tricks. Essential pieces are missing. The recent history of attempts to understand and duplicate the activities of the mind simply underscore this point. When scientists have ventured to reproduce the types of activities of the mind in the area of language, vision, and other topics touched in the previous session, brave claims and anticipation have generally yielded to disappointment and retrenchment. During the discussion of recent experiments, we gave a few hints of where things appear to be going, and it is these areas I would like to develop now. During the discussion of the history of learning, a remark was made that you may have overlooked in the rush of things, which I believe provides a key for the resolution. It was mentioned that, although the concept of logical deduction from first principles is still an important element in present-day science, science has been released from the earlier necessity of divining the precise truth to that of developing models that are adequate to explain the results of reproducible experiments. Modern scientists, unlike the earlier philosophers, do not seek for the perfect a prioris and the absolutely correct deduction. An author of a recent textbook on artificial intelligence states this. At one time, philosophers thought that the reason behind science's unique history of progress was its ability to prove or confirm its theories. As such, science could be viewed as accumulating knowledge where each block in the structure is secure because it's proven true. While this model has a certain plausible ring, what our experiments were, after all, it is hard for us in the 20th century to take it seriously. The two great accomplishments of 20th century physics, quantum mechanics and relativity, together overturned one of the great intellectual structures of all time, classical physics. If science proves its theories, then there must have been an awful lot of sloppy physicists who somehow made a mistake when they thought they had proven classical physics. The best articulated response to this dilemma was put forth by Karl Popper. Karl Popper is was a British philosopher in the 50s and 60s, primarily 60s and 70s, who suggested that the purpose of experiments was not to prove theories, but to disprove them. He noted that while any set of experiments could not prove a theory, any set of data is consistent with an infinite number of possible theories, experiments could disprove a theory. That is, if the numbers do not turn out the right way, the theory must be wrong. Thus, the reason science progresses is that scientists propose testable theories and then proceed to run experiments. Quote. This ancient self-imposed burden to have everything just so is largely abandoned, except in limited areas such as mathematics where precise deduction is essential. But even in mathematics, the companion burden to have the a priori's pass some test of absolute truth, which absorbed a tremendous amount of energy in the part of ancient philosophers, is gone. In fact, one of the great advances in the modern era of mathematics came when it was realized that Euclid's five axioms of geometry ain't necessarily so. And it doesn't even matter if they are. Given this emancipating fact, mathematicians gleefully invented various non-Euclidean geometries, Minkowski space, Riemannian geometry, and so on. The modern space-time concepts, including Einstein's general theory of relativity, could not have been possible without these developments. The mind uses methods that have not yet been expressed and incorporated into formal intellectual methodology. What are these additional methods? I believe that a major missing component in the methodology is an understanding of the role of what I call process. C.S. Lewis, in his book Surprised by Joy, which is primarily about his conversion, made a philosophical remark that has stuck with me ever since reading the book. He stated that a person can't contemplate and enjoy a thing at the same time. As he uses the term, contemplate means to think about a thing, and enjoy means to participate in the thing. Basically, C.S. Lewis was referring to his past life, that it is hard to stand back and see and evaluate the drama as a person is acting out his life. It's only later he reflects on it that the evaluation occurs. I think this is a very useful distinction between contemplation and enjoyment. And I think something of the same distinction fits the subject that we are in today. What the mind does in its reasoning processes is two things that take place concurrently. It enjoys its task, in other words, it does whatever it's doing, like seeing, and it also contemplates the task. In the case of the mind, however, the contemplation takes place at a much higher level than merely thinking about what is taking place. It is an attempt to model what is going on, to give it a kind of fictional, independent existence. This model of the mind is used to aid in the reasoning process and, in fact, becomes in most common activities of the mind almost indistinguishable from logical deduction. It is this modeling activity, this role of contemplation by the mind, that I believe represents the largest missing ingredient in attempts to duplicate what the mind does. And it is the lack of this component that explains the general failure of the attempts mentioned above. The essential part of the reasoning process is modeling, the process of extracting the essence out of the data the mind receives and representing the data in some analogous but simpler way. The building blocks of models are processes. I'm giving you some technical definitions. A process is a way of doing something, a description. When a process is completely described in a consistent way, the resultant description is called an algorithm. Models, processes, and algorithms. These are the central building blocks of the human reasoning. Logical deduction and the components of classical and contemporary intellectual methodology are the energy that powers these components and what glues them together in a reasonable way. Actually, the concept of process is not at all new. However, practical considerations have made it impossible to integrate the process in an adequate way. Progress in science is remarkably dependent on bending metal, that is, the technical ability needed to conduct experiments. The same is true of process. What has prevented progress in extending the horizons of intellectual advance in the area of process has been the lack of adequate tools for the job. Research in the area has in the past been almost laughably primitive as viewed from the vantage point of the human mental process. And the main reason for this is the lack of tools, specific computational power. It may come as a surprise to some of you, but the fact is the computer age is barely upon us. We are still in the pre-Wright brothers era of computers, or perhaps at best a month or two after their first flight. All of the hype that you hear about the power of computers, how fast they are, how much capacity and so on, is empty talk in comparison with the kinds of capacity needed to engage in serious process work. You see models of process everywhere in the scientific world, but almost universally they are only faint shadows of the things they are trying to model. Economic models attempt to describe the effects of given actions in the economy. Environmental models try to capture the weather. These investigations of process are universally defective, and the reason is simply a lack of adequate tools, particularly a deep understanding that would lead to effective algorithms. One of the occupational hazards of the current age is a direct result of this information explosion. More and more people are forced to engage in leaps of faith in assessing the facts that they face. It is virtually impossible to investigate even a minute fraction of the relevant data about a given issue. This same hazard is present in scientific investigations. In the face of a necessity to deal with facts and processes that are beyond the capacity of present-day equipment, assumptions are made that are equivalent to the leaps of faith. I believe that there is a whole unseen and largely unrecognized world of processes and algorithms that the mind uses in its rational processes, and that these are perhaps there are perhaps centuries of hard work ahead of us in attempting to understand these processes. The same motivations that have driven scholarly work in the past will drive us in the future to discover this new world. Because the prototype of proper thought is the mind, and a correct understanding of how the mind works will be beneficial to the investigation of God's creation and can lead to a better understanding of it if pursued honestly. The intellectual world needs to integrate the concept of process into its notions of proof, provability, and the reasoning process. It needs to take more literally the observation of Popper quoted above, that we have to be released from the impossible burden of seeking to prove theories using some narrow definition of proof, and rather go to the development of models, processes, and algorithms which can then be subjected to the easier test of disproof. I believe that the information age is bringing on a radical change in the historic view of the nature of proof and the reasoning process. This change is in the direction of a better appreciation of how the human mind works. I believe that the current intellectual turmoil and apparent flight from rationality in the academic world is systematic of the need for change and what that change is coming. I believe that this new age of AI brings with it exciting opportunities for the Christian to express his faith, and an understanding of these intellectual forces at work will equip him to counsel and convey the gospel message of salvation through faith. That completes my talk. I was at Wendy's or something like that on the way tonight, and as I told Bob, every time I sit down, I think of a couple more pages I want to say. And it occurred to me that perhaps I hadn't adequately defended the question of why process is not being properly given credence in the scientific methodology today. So just bear with me another 3 minutes and I'll read a little bit more. The current method of development of process is in comparison to where it should go, as the alchemy of the Middle Ages is to the chemistry of today. This is not intended as a disparaging remark. In fact, I suspect that most people today have a totally distorted view of alchemy. Chemistry would not be where it is today without the work of alchemists. Most science today grossly underestimates the importance of process, and they wrongly magnify the relative importance of conventional technology. This fact can be seen in almost any high-tech development today. Too much effort goes into building the thing relative to the effort put into making it work. Recall the illustration of the eye given earlier in this talk. I would say that regardless of the technical accomplishments in making an eye, the difficulty of making visual perception is 1,000 times greater. And the perception is what makes it work. The reason the IRS computer system fell on its face is that 95% of the effort went into the hardware and only 5% into making it work. And that's the truth. I don't know if it's 95%, but whatever the number is, it's the truth. Science and engineering routinely underestimate the effort needed to make things work by orders of magnitude. But you may ask, if process is so difficult, why do I think it will ever get better? Will we ever do it better? Will the alchemists of process ever evolve to chemistry? I think if you look at the tool bags of process, you can see a gradual improvement that leads me to believe that significant advances are ahead, but at great effort. For example, the high-level computer languages that have made remarkable advances over the past two decades. Interestingly, the best advances are usually obtained through simplification. One of my favorite computer languages today is called C. Probably don't know a thing about C, that's all right. C is distinctive in that the typical algorithm is very brief. In fact, there are one-line C programs that can do important tasks. But brevity is not itself a virtue. After all, there's another language called ATL that is also brief, but is extremely cryptic. C is not like that. C is easy to read and it's brief. C and similar modern high-level languages make heavy use of tree structures. In essence, this means taking a complex idea and breaking it into a series of simpler parts, going up the branches of a tree, so to speak. If you want to address the leaves, and you address each leaf, you've got to address a million leaves. If you can address the leaves by going to the branches in the trunk, then you have a lot easier, it's a much simpler task. If you can put a hypodermic needle into the trunk and cure the leaves, that's a much easier job than fixing the leaves. That was just simply intended to fortify my notion that I think scientists underestimate process. Maybe you're all mad at me now. But I'm finished. Thank you very much for your attention.
May I ask you some questions here? I'll let David get away without having to answer some questions.
Incidentally, a very interesting whole book on the subject of a process is The Evolution of Cooperation, which talks about if you have two antagonists who are hostile to each other, how should they behave to each other? Should they try to do each other in, or should they perhaps cooperate with each other sometimes, even though they hate them? I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's a whole book written on what's called The Prisoner's Dilemma, which is a very interesting. It's a simple application of process. Robert Axelrod. In fact, it's available in Encore books, and it's currently fairly popular. Very interesting, very readable, and I think you'd find it fascinating. And it has great theological implications. Wish so, Dr. McRae.
Do you want to have any questions?
Yes.
I want to comment that comes to my mind when speaking about recognizing letters.
Yes.
I want to note that my handwriting isn't my speed up as clear as I'd like it, and I write quite a word, and then that's recognizable, and then I try to go ahead and correct it. And I go correcting it. Often it's not, it gets less recognizable when I crack it. You know what I mean? Even though the letters are
there,
but it doesn't look like handwriting anymore. And therefore, it's not quite
recognized. That's the dilemma of enjoyment versus contemplation, perhaps. I'm not sure that was an accurate application of C.S. Lewis's concepts, but I think it's pretty close. Yes.
As you talk about the future of artificial intelligence, I'm getting the impression that you feel major strides will be more in terms of software development, in terms of information processing, and the ability to get rid of unnecessary pieces of information going part of the process, as opposed to just a lot of the money being invested now by the United States and Japan in the development of supercomputers, and people are trying to develop new and larger boards to eliminate the time, in essence, to speed up computational time in computers.
Both are necessary. When I was talking about it barely being to the Wright brothers, if you think for a minute what you want to do, at one time, you know, I had this naive notion I was going to put an index to my books in my library on a computer. And with vast amount of effort, I do less than I can. I mean, you know, I still don't use it. Because my mind can just run through those 10,000 books, and I want the blue book that's in the third shelf over there.
I mean, you know, in an instant, I can, you know, I can run circles around any kind of information retrieval system. If you think in terms of even a modest library, you're talking about perhaps 10,000 books or something like that. You're talking about trillions of words, or billions of words anyway. Computers are only, I mean, present-day computers are barely able to do decent information retrieval on that size. And, I mean, do it intelligently. Now, I'm sure they can look for a word, but to look for a concept, or how a concept is developed, or the relationships between concepts, that requires phenomenal computer power. And so I think the hardware technology is going to enable us to begin doing the things that we can conceive of how we'd like to have computers help us. I'd like to be able to look at an item in the newspaper and say, I wonder if that makes sense. I think I'd tap into my computer and find out who else talked about that general area and get an answer in something less than light years, okay? Or it's costing something less than hundreds of dollars, okay? So I think the computers are necessary, but I don't think that's the answer. I mean, that's, again, the fixation on hardware, as if that's going to solve our problems. That just begins the work. And I maintain that systematically, through all R&D, research and development, hardware is overemphasized relative to the concept developments in software. They talk about launching a surveillance satellite network that's going to cost $40 billion, and they'll spend $50 million on the software. Well, you know, I mean, you know, maybe both of those numbers probably bog your mind, but I mean, never mind. I mean, the relative amount is ridiculous. Because the hardware is the easy part of the job. I mean, just getting trillions and trillions of bits of data coming to you doesn't mean a thing unless you can do something with it. And that's like building an excellent eye that doesn't know how to recognize anything. And it is almost universal among, especially the technical people, they don't even think of processes being anything that's even real. I mean, you know, it's just kind of, I know how to bend metal, I know how to, you know, look at my electron microscope, but I don't know what it means. I don't know what it means to process. What does that mean? Yes.
Another part of that, when you draw your analogy with Euclidean geometry versus non-Euclidean, would you use the same type of analogy to determine where we need to go in innovation, innovative types of information processing? Do you see a gap being that large? Or are AI people today coming to grips with new processing?
I think the problem at the present time is people working in AI are not innovating new concepts. They're applying things that work other places. Like when you talk about visual perception, they'll say, well, let's try a Fourier transform on the visual perception, or whatever a Fourier transform is, it doesn't matter. Well, you know, that's something that's used worked in engineering. Maybe it'll work here. Or maybe we'll do density scaling kind of image recognition, boundary searches and so forth. You know, things that have been tried other places, we'll try here, rather than innovate. And the latest thing, the knowledge base. What we need is just vast amounts of knowledge. I don't think the eye works because of vast amounts of knowledge. The eye works because of the way it handles the data it has in a remarkable way. For example, just the context. When you're looking, your mind already knows where you are. And you get the feel for that when you ever get disoriented and you momentarily forget where you are. And, you know, lots of things don't make any sense when you're disoriented. An essential part of seeing something is knowing the context you're in, and you know that kind of thing is powerful. But I don't think that. It's how do I predict the future? You know, I don't. I just think that artificial intelligence is just barely getting off the ground. It's sort of like the alchemy. Without disparaging the alchemy, those of you who are practitioners of it.
Questions.
This was a fun paper.
Very enjoyable to listen to.
For me, it was fun.
Snowed us all. We have lots of refreshments down in the basement. More than